Right, so we are at the parable of what is called the unrighteous steward in Luke chapter 16, verses 1 through 18. You feel like reading the first 13 chapters, or chapters, first 13 verses there, Randy?
Sure. Luke 16, 1 through 13. Now he was also saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes." And he summoned each of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, "Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, "How much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. The sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth."
Okay. So, as I was reading through this again, I thought, why did Jesus all of a sudden bring this up? Is this at all related to what he's been speaking about? Okay, how so?
Well, I mean, he is, of previous parables that he has been teaching, he has, even in the last one that he did, it was about the two different sons, and the value that, and so now he's talking about, even though one son took off and wasted his substance, his inheritance, as it were, he repented and came back. But the other one was, seemed to me anyway, in some ways, to be almost jealous of the one who went off and got to do whatever he wanted, and then came back and got the fatted calf, as it were. But he's trying to show that perhaps the son, the older son, who stayed and did his job and served his father like he was supposed to, that how do you serve? Do you serve with your with yourself in mind, or with your master in mind?
Okay. When I look back this to trying to say, well, why did he all of a sudden say this? We look at chapter 15 and verse 13. Chapter 15, verse 13. It says that the younger son went off into a far country, and there he wasted his substance with riotous living. And then here in the first verse of chapter 16, it says that the same was accused unto him that he was wasting his goods. We have here, and then, of course, at the end, right down there in verse 13 of chapter 16, it says in the American Standard, "You cannot serve God and mammon." What does the New American say there?
Wealth.
You cannot serve God and wealth. He is making a tie-in here based on what's been going on. He has, once again, or still, I should say, a general audience that includes what the Pharisees and scribes call publicans and sinners. So the publicans and sinners and the scribes and the Pharisees are all there. They're all listening to what he has to say. And he's telling these three parables, and then now this fourth parable all to give them God's view of how people ought to live their lives. And in this instance, we have a man that was accused already of wasting his master's goods. And then later on, we get into the fact that he was further wasting his master's goods, you might say. When we get a little bit further down, we'll talk about that. And well, I guess we can do that anytime. In verse 2, he says to render the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. He's telling him he's essentially got to close out the books because his job is over. And this is audit time. He wants to know what's going on. The steward needs to report back to him the status of his responsibility, I guess you should say. Now, of course, we talked last time a little bit peripherally about the fact that he doesn't have the strength to dig, and he's too ashamed to beg. He knows he's lost his job, but he's also got to report to the master what is due to the master. Now, if we read through the next two short paragraphs are the subject matter right here, when he's talking to the people that owe his master something, we see indeed that there was apparently already an understanding of what they owed. And of course, it was obvious that they understood that they each owed 100 of the whatever it is that they needed to pay back. So the one ordered, owed, I should say, oil, and the other one owed wheat. Now, why would they owe him oil and wheat? I mean, was that the form of currency these days? Lynn?
It is possible that they were the perhaps middlemen between the harvesters and the merchants. That they, you know, said, okay, you've given, we now have 100 measures or whatever of oil and wheat, you know, we will be sure that you're guaranteed that these will be sold. And therefore we owe you we'll pay you X amount for this. But they may not have had that at that point in time. They may have said, if your crop brings this, then we will do this. It's very vague to me as to how this might have taken
place. I get the impression that these people were what we refer to as sharecroppers. In other words, the rich man, because it just says calls him a certain rich man. The steward said to both of these people, how much do you owe my master? Now, we need to not get caught up in these pronouns. We have a tendency to make a big deal out of calling somebody you or somebody there, as far as it's, you know, your God or my God or something like that. Many times it simply has to do with normal conversation. And so when he says, how much do you owe my master, doesn't mean that the master is not the master of them also. It simply says that you owe them, you owe him. And both of them knew, the one that he owed 100 measures of oil and the other that he owed 100 measures of wheat. And I'm thinking that the only way that I can really reconcile that is that they must have been people that were responsible for harvesting his lands. Now, obviously these are very round numbers, 100 measures of oil, 100 measures of wheat. It's just indicating a certain magnitude. And plus, it makes the division easy. He talks to the first one and he says, how much do you owe my master? So there's already been an agreement somewhere, and most likely it's just between he doesn't even say what he's each of his lord's debtors. Okay. He asked the debtor, how much do you owe? So the debtor knew how much he owed the master. It would appear that the agreement must have been between the debtor and the steward without necessarily informing the master about that. I mean, the steward is there for the purpose of taking care of the debtor's, I mean, the master's business. And so the rich man wouldn't have had a steward unless he wanted him to take care of something. So, and the New American Standard uses a different word than steward.
Manager.
Okay. This person was a manager, and he needed to manage things. And so the agreement between these two debtors could very well have just been the understanding between these debtors and the manager or steward could very well have been just between the debtors and the manager without necessarily the knowledge of the master, because the master put the steward in charge. Yes, sir?
At first, it looks like the master wanted to get something from the people that owed him, and the steward acted prudently by asking for just 50% of what they had, and the master was happy about that.
Yeah, we're running.
That's something.
You're running way ahead of us here. So you're running way ahead of us here. Yes, Jenny.
Lynn says, what about an independent audit, or was this a test to see if the steward would be honest?
I don't believe it was a test, because it already calls him right at the beginning an unrighteous steward. So there's no reason for the master to test this man, because he knew he was already knew he was dishonest, because he was accused of wasting his goods already, even before we get into these stories about the debtor and the steward. So he's already, you might say, a criminal. Latanya?
Who said that he was mishandling the money because of they were borrowing money and wasn't paying for what they was getting? Because they was borrowing.
Not necessarily. I mean, if they were being given, for example, a farm to work, and they were to bring in a crop, and they were to give the master so much percentage or something like that, okay, then like sharecroppers, or I think there's another word for it, but I forget what it is. But
lords and peasants.
Lords and peasants. Or lords and pheasants, one or the other. But
tenant farmers.
Yeah. Tenant farmers are those that live on somebody else's land. They're given they can, you know, live the way they wish, and so they're required would be required to give a certain percentage of that which they harvested. And I imagine the master would check once in a while and say, "Ooh, you got a good crop of corn, and you know, I'm expecting a good profit out of this." And but the thing is that the tenant farmer or the sharecropper or the in this instance, identified as the debtor, would himself make a profit out of this. We see that there's a chain of money, as it were, going all the way through here. You look as though you have something you need to say.
You said that he was called an unjust steward from the beginning, but he was not called that until verse 8.
The same was accused unto him that he was wasting his goods.
He
was accused, and then later on, only a few verses later, it calls him an unjust steward.
Yes.
Therefore, we can conclude, though not necessarily, that he was already an unjust steward.
Yes.
Oh.
It's just that the way he worded it, I felt like that the wording called him unjust from the beginning rather than accused.
No, yeah, no. They called him scum right from the beginning. Though that's probably not in that translation. Okay. All right. So he was accused of wasting his goods, and it's not what... Where did you say, Linda? How far down do we go? Not too far. 8? And the thing is that in verse 2, it says, "Render the account of thy stewardship, for thou canst no longer be steward." The accusations, as far as the master was concerned, were already true. And he's just firing the guy. But he says, before you leave, let me know what people owe me. So he talks to these two debtors, and makes an agreement with them. Now, it's strange to think that he would talk to them, and to the first one that owed him the 100 measures of oil, he would give him a 50% reduction. And to the one that owed him 100 measures of wheat, he'd give him a 20% reduction. As you've read in the commentary, there's a number of different thoughts on how this could be. But the fact of the matter is that the master was probably not aware of what was going on. And so he had the guys write bill promissory notes. So it may have been just what we might call a gentleman's agreement up till that time of how much you owed based on the crop you had brought in or whatever. But now he's having him write it down. All right, I owe you 50 measures of oil. Now, why would a person that was a farmer owe anybody oil? Where do you get oil from?
Olive
oil. Okay. So if you have an olive orchard, one of the products out of an olive orchard then is going to be olive oil, in addition to the edible olives, which obviously once you squeeze them wouldn't be very edible anymore unless you want olive mash. You know, and a lot of these byproducts are given to the livestock. Olives might be given to the cattle or to the sheep or something after they're done squeezing the oil out of them. I know when I worked on a cotton gin that I would truck the seeds down to a seed mill, and they would feed those seeds to cattle, no accounting for the taste of cattle. He reduced the debt that was promised by 50% to one guy and 20% to the other guy. Apparently it doesn't really say what their attitude was. It just says sit down in verse 6. Sit down, take your bond. It says in the American Standard, sit down and write 50. And in verse 7 it says take thy bond and write 80. And that's as far as we see about his contact with the debtors. As we get into Wayne's comment here about the fact that it comes down and it says in verse 8, it says, the Lord commended the unrighteous steward because he had done wisely, for the sons of this world are for their own generation wiser than the sons of light. I'm not going to concur that the master was happy about this. What he's saying is simply that I think probably what he's thinking, given the implications here, is that perhaps he wished that the steward had that much initiative when he was his employee. The steward obviously was looking out for himself much more than he had been looking out for his master. And now it says that his master commended him because he had done something that would set him well with the people that are around him now that he was out of a job, so that he wouldn't have to dig or beg. And really, that's essentially all we see about the master is there in verse 8. His Lord commended the unrighteous steward because he had done wisely. So what he had done was a wise thing for him to do. There's a lot of wise things that snakes will do. And a snake could be commended for doing things wisely. That doesn't make him any less dangerous or any less hurtful. The man is saying, yep, you've certainly done a good job of looking out for yourself. The master is now out, it would appear, out a certain amount of profit. Now, there's one of the hypotheses was that since this man was a manager, a steward, he wasn't a slave, as near as we can tell, so he was an employee, and it's obvious from the context that he was simply firing him. He wasn't taking him out and having him shot or anything like that. The guy was commended. Would praise be another word for commend, maybe?
That's why it says praise.
It does say praise. Okay. The master recognizes this, but the master is perhaps out a certain amount of profit. One of the hypotheses was that the steward would have received a certain cut out of what the master was going to get. And it's entirely possible that his cut out of the oil would have been greater than his cut out of the wheat. And he may have just given up his portion And the master has his own, so to speak. Kali doesn't believe that. He says it's more obvious that the steward just cut and run type thing. He just did what he could to make sure that he was okay, not whether his master was taken care of or not. I doubt that this was any sort of sacrifice on the part of the steward, but rather it ended up, I think, being a sacrifice on the part of the master. And then in verse 9, Jesus continues to talk, or Jesus continues to teach specifically. And when he says to make yourselves friends of mammon, in other words, he's saying, I personally think what he's saying is don't divorce yourself from the world such that you can't interact with people that are in the world. That seems to be reasonable. And in 9, it still uses wealth, right?
Yeah.
I think now we've gotten to a more, perhaps you might, this is where the spiritual application comes in. That Jesus is not going to tell these things without obviously making a spiritual application. So I think here, when Jesus goes on to say that to make yourselves friends of mammon, make yourself friends by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it shall fail, they may receive you into the eternal tabernacles. And I just thought of this. There's one where it says to be wise as something and as subtle as... Pardon?
Wise as serpents, but as innocent as doves, that one? Or?
That sounds right. Wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Find that, Jenny?
Matthew 10:16.
Would you like to read that, Jenny?
Sure. Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves.
All right. Jesus says this as he's sending the disciples. Yeah. Verse 5, these 12 Jesus sent forth and charged them, don't go to the Gentiles and not to the Samaritans, but go to the lost house of Israel. They're going out and preaching the gospel, as it were. Well, that's what they're doing. And he tells them to be sheep in the midst of wolves, to be wise, and also to be gentle. I lost the verse. Harmless. Yeah, Randy.
Slightly different connotation, but both passages, the one we just read in Matthew and on Luke, doesn't say wise, it says shrewd.
Okay.
So in verse Matthew 10:16, behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves.
Oh.
And then Luke 16:8.
Sons
of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light.
No, okay.
It's interesting. ESV says wise in Matthew, but shrewd in Luke.
Yeah, yes, I've noticed that in some of the versions that sometimes they'll be consistent, da, 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 and then all of a sudden they'll change. And go, well, why did you change here? I'm sure there must be some overriding reason. Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, in verse 8, and it says the Lord.
Evidently the same word.
Are they the same? Huh? What is it?
Pronobos, P-H-R-O-N-I-N-O-S, means wise or prudent.
Okay, wise or prudent.
So,
all right, the same word in both of them. Yes, Carolyn.
A few verses later in the Matthew 10 passage, down in 23.
23 in Matthew.
Says, but whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. Truly I say to you, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. So there's a sense of, use your head when you're talking to people about spiritual things. And sometimes you just have to look around you and, as another passage says, shake the dust off your sandals and go someplace where maybe someone will listen.
Okay, yes. All right. We need to make the application here based on, you know, what the scriptures say everywhere. And these are some good references here. I was thinking back in verse 8 also. It's where Jesus said the Lord commended the unrighteous steward because he had done wisely or shrewdly or... What was the other word?
Prudent.
Prudently. He says, for the sons of this world... for their own are for their own generation wiser than the sons of light. We see indeed that many times people that are Christians are portrayed as weak and unwilling to stand up for anything. Okay. But they're told to be wise, that there are serpents out there, that there are people that, you know, as it were, that were out to get them. And we don't need to be blind to what's going on in the world. We have to make sure that we take proper precautions, that we live our lives properly, while it's still at the same time being examples to other people. So we have to live in the world, but as it says, not of the world. And Jesus is not teaching them here in verses 8 and 9 to be of the world. But it's much like you might say when Paul called his Roman citizenship into play in a couple of places, because it went to the furtherance of the gospel. He used his civic, I want to say privileges, but
circumstances.
Yeah, he used his civic circumstances in such a way that not only would he at least temporarily avoid harm, but also would be given the opportunity to preach the gospel further. So we need to be able to use the things of this world in such a way that like here, that Jesus would commend us as being wise for doing that. But and he'll make the point as he comes along here that indeed there's a line there that you certainly may not cross and must not cross. All right. Linda.
I was reading here in the commentary about that, and it says, when it says the children of this world, they are focused on the here and now. They are clever and shrewd, but they expect to inherit only what this world offers. They live in their generation without regard to the age to come. God's children live for the hereafter, even though they may enjoy many wonderful righteous blessings of God while preparing. So it's...
Well, I mean, in our prayers, constantly, consistently, we thank God for the fact that of how much we have. And we can compare ourselves to people around the world and say that we have just so much more than so many other people. But Jesus is also telling us that we need to not be wrapped up in that, because that's the unrighteous mammon, or the worldly wealth that people sometimes aim for as their goal, when in fact that's not supposed to be the goal. So we can live and take care of ourselves, but there are then obligations that we have to God that come. Where do our obligations to God come? First? Okay, first. Yeah, that seems reasonable. And as a matter of fact, that's what God says. When Jesus says to make friends by the means of mammon of unrighteousness, that when it shall fail, they may receive you in the eternal tabernacles, we see now that we've moved into the spiritual realm here. Because he's talking about eternal tabernacles. So the comparison is made about what's been commented on, that the steward and the, therefore the people like him that are working for the things of this world are really not wise, and they're not going to receive the eternal tabernacles. Does it say that's at the end of 9, I think? Is that eternal something for you? Eternal dwelling. Okay. What did you say, Linda?
Well, I'm not real sure what the one is here, but it says everlasting habitations.
Everlasting habitations. Okay. So now that's the point that Jesus is trying to make, is that this man looked out for his future, and he's saying, as this man was commended by his master for doing something that would look out well for his future, you need to be the person that will be commended by your master, who is God, for looking out for your eternal kingdom, or eternal abode. And that's why at the end of 9, he talks about the eternal tabernacles. And I think the last phrase in verse 8, it says, for the sons of this world, or this age, are for their own generation wiser than the sons of light. What he's saying is that in a general nature, that the people of this world are looking out for themselves all the time. And if you're not looking out for heaven all the time, then you're going to end up being just like them, really, is what the implication here is. And then he talks about little and much. And so in verse 11, he talks about, if you haven't been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, or what does 11 say in the New American?
Unrighteous wealth.
Unrighteous wealth. Okay, is that the ESV also? So if we haven't been wise in that, in other words, or faithful, it says, in that, who will commit to us the true riches? He's showing that we certainly need to be responsible for the things that we have in this world. And if we're not properly responsible for them and looking out for them and with them in the way that he is telling us that we need to do, then we won't receive those eternal tabernacles. And we've been committed with true riches, and we need to make sure that we can be trusted with those true riches. And this unrighteous steward was not trustworthy. And he really stole his master's goods all the way down the line, it looks like, as near as we can tell. Jesus is saying, be wise. But he's also saying, don't be stupid about it. You know, you have to make sure that you understand where the priority is in your life. In 10, it talks about faithful in a little is faithful in much. Righteous and unrighteous in very little is unrighteous also in much. That reminds me once again, going back to Ezekiel chapters 3 and 33, that talks about the person that lived a righteous life, and then when he got older, he gave up on that righteous life. And the Holy Spirit tells us that even though he lived a life of righteousness all the time, when he gave it up later on, then his righteous life didn't count for anything. And the converse was also true, is that if a person lived a wicked life, but realized, like the younger son, that he came to himself and realized that what he was doing was wrong and gave that up and turned to God, that then his wicked life would not be counted against him. So the same thing is here when we talk about if you're faithful in a few things. And when it comes right down to it, the things that we have here on this earth compared to what God is going to give us are a few things. And we need to consider them that. And we need to consider the true riches much more valuable and of much greater quantity, you might say. And then when he says that if you're unrighteous in a little, you're also unrighteous in much, you see so many people running amok. And the thing is that there are people that consider themselves fairly good people. And so they're unrighteous in a little. But it says here that they're unrighteous in much. We need to try and be righteous in everything that we do. Were you tempted to put your hand up?
I was thinking about the fact that sometimes very small things can show whether you are, to yourself at least, and the others, that you are trying to be honest. I remember going to the store and the clerk gave me back too much money. And I didn't say to myself, I scored. Woo! You know, no. I said, excuse me, I think you made a mistake. And of course they immediately go on the defensive because they think that you're trying to get more money out of them. And I'm saying, no, you gave me too much change back, and you need your, you know, basically your drawer is going to be short tonight,
yeah.
because of this, and I want to give it back to you. And usually they were just stunned. Because normally it's the other way around, but if people are that careful, if they're being cheated.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting how people will be stunned by honesty.
You know, it wasn't much money, but it was the fact that I recognized that a mistake had been made, and it was, even though it would have been in my favor, that didn't make it mine to keep.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have been unrighteous mammon.
Right. Yes. So.
All right.
That way.
Okay. So, faithful in a little is faithful in much. Unrighteous in a little is unrighteous also in much. We need to make sure that we understand that there's. I had a sermon that I brought a number of years ago called Mountains and Molehills. Because a favorite phrase of people that want to combat you is, well, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. Everything with God is a mountain. There are no molehills. That's why he says that if you're righteous in much or in little, you're righteous in much. If you're unrighteous in a little, you're unrighteous in much. God sees it all, and he expects us all to be on the top of the hill, not halfway down or down at the bottom. I think that's what, when we're talking about the lose my train of thought all the time, faithful in much and faithful in little, that's the point that he's trying to make. Now he brings it home. If you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? And of course, that would refer back also to the previous, or verse 11, that says, who will commit to your trust the true riches? All right, so let's finish up through 18, and then we'll continue on through 19 through 31 if we finish up our discussion next time.